Chapter 56. With an incredible display of casual indifference to sniper bullets, Pembroke Smythe sat under the torrid sun on a shooting stick, a spiked cane that opens into a seat, and observed the Malian formations as they lined up for the assault. "I do believe the beggars are about to make another go," he informed Levant and Pitt. A series of flares were shot in the air to signal the advance. There was no dodging with covering fire like the previous assault. The Malian force raced over the flat ground at a dead run. Shouts erupted and echoed over the desert from nearly 2,000 throats. Pitt felt like an actor on a stage in a theater in the round, surrounded by a hostile audience. "Not exactly what you'd call tactical imagination," he said, standing beside Levant and Pembroke Smythe while staring at the massed column. "But it just may do the trick." Pembroke Smythe nodded. "Kazim is using his men like a steamroller." "Good luck, gentlemen," said Levant with a grim smile. "Perhaps we'll all meet in hell." "Couldn't be hotter than here," Pitt grinned back. The colonel looked at Pembroke Smythe. "Reposition our units to repulse a single frontal assault, then tell them to fire at will." Pembroke Smythe shook hands with Pitt and began moving from man to man. Levant took his place atop the remaining parapet as Pitt returned to the little fort he had dug from the rubble. Already bullets were splattering the fortress and ricocheting off the broken stone. The forward wall of the attacking force stretched 50 meters wide. With the reinforcements, they numbered almost 1,800. Kazim threw them against the side of the fort that had suffered the worst during the later aerial attacks and mortar bombardments. This was the north wall with the shattered main gate. The men in the rear ranks were cheered by the certainty that they would be alive to drive inside the fort. The men in the forward wall had different ideas. None expected to cross that open space of death and survive. They knew there was to be no mercy from the defenders ahead or their own forces behind. Already gaps began to appear in the first rank as the pitifully few men in the fort laid down an appalling fire. But the Malians pushed forward in their headlong onslaught, leaping over the bodies of those who fell in the first assault. There was no stopping them this time. They could smell the bloody scent of victory. Pitt aimed and fired off short bursts at the approaching mass as a man in a dream. Aim and fire, then eject and reload. The routine, it seemed to him, continued endlessly when in fact only 10 minutes had passed since the signal for the assault. A mortar shell burst somewhere behind him. Kazim had directed the bombardment be kept up until his leading ranks entered the fort. Pitt felt the shrapnel whistle past his head, felt the tiny breeze of its passing. The Malians were so close now they filled up the sights of his machine gun. Mortar shell after mortar shell rained down in a maelstrom of fire. Then the barrage ceased as elements of the first rank reached the fallen rubble and began scrambling over the jagged stone. Here they were most vulnerable. The forward ranks melted away as they were raked by the desperate fire of the defenders. There was no place for them to take cover, and they could not climb over the rubble and shoot at the same time at targets that didn't show themselves. The defenders, on the other hand, couldn't miss. The Malians stumbled and crawled over the broken masonry into a swarm of bullets. The first rank had been swept away at 100 meters, the second by the time it reached the shadow of the fort. Then the rank behind that. All along the north wall, the attackers and their officers cried out and fell. Their massed fire, however, no matter how wild, could not help but strike some of the defenders. There were simply too many for the UN team to stop, and their fire began to slacken as one by one they were killed or wounded. Levant knew disaster was only moments away. "Blast them!" he roared over the helmet radios. "Blast them back off the wall!" It seemed impossible, but the hail of bullets from the UN team suddenly increased. The head of the Malian column was shot to a standstill. Pitt was out of ammunition, but was throwing grenades as fast as he could activate them. The explosions caused havoc in the struggling crowd. The Malians began to fall back. They were stunned and disbelieving that anyone could fight with such fury and wrath. Only with determined courage did they rally and surge through the splintered remains of the main gate. The UN team rose from their dugouts, firing from the hip as they retired across the parade ground and around their smoldering personnel carriers, forming a new line of defense within the ruins of the former Legion barracks and officers' quarters. Dust, debris, and smoke cut visibility to less than 5 meters. The constant blast of guns had deafened the fighters to the cries of the wounded. The horrible casualties inflicted on the Malians were enough to shatter the morale of any attacking force, but they kept coming and poured into the fort in a human flood. Temporarily exposed on the parade ground, the first company of men through the wall were shredded as they milled around in confusion at not finding a pathetic few survivors caught in the open. Pembroke Smythe took a head count inside the collapsed barracks and officers' quarters as the few wounded they were able to save were carried down into the arsenal. Only Pitt and 12 of the UN tactical team were still capable of fighting. Colonel Levant was missing. He was last seen firing from the parapet when the attacking horde broke through the remains of the North Gate. At recognizing Pitt, Pembroke Smythe flashed a smile. "You look positively awful, old man," he said, nodding at the red stains in Pitt's combat suit that were spreading on the left arm and shoulder. Blood also trickled down the side of one cheek from a cut caused by a shard of flying stone. "You're no picture of health yourself," Pitt replied, pointing at the nasty wound in Pembroke Smythe's hip. "How's your ammo?" Pitt held up his remaining submachine gun and let it drop to the ground. "Gone. I'm down to 2 grenades." Pembroke Smythe handed him an enemy machine gun. "You'd better get down in the arsenal. What's left of us will hold them off until you can—" He couldn't bring himself to finish, and he stared down at the ground. "We hurt them badly," Pitt said steadily, as he ejected the clip and counted the bullets inside. "They're like mad dogs drooling for revenge. They'll make it hard on whoever of us they find still living. The women and children cannot fall into Kazim's hands again." "They won't suffer," Pitt promised. Pembroke Smythe stared up at him, seeing the agony of grief in Pitt's eyes. "Goodbye, Mr. Pitt. It has indeed been an honor to know you." Pitt shook the captain's hand as a storm of gunfire burst around them. "Likewise, Captain." Pitt turned away and scrambled down through the debris choking the stairway into the arsenal. Hopper and Fairweather saw him at the same time and approached. "Who's winning?" Hopper asked. Pitt shook his head. "Not our side." "No sense in waiting for death," said Fairweather. "Better to make a fight of it. You wouldn't happen to have a spare gun on you?"
"I could use one, too," added Hopper.
Pitt handed Fairweather the machine gun.
"Sorry, except for my automatic, it's all I have. There are plenty of weapons topside, but you'll have to snatch one off a dead Malian."
"Sounds like good sport," boomed Hopper. He gave Pitt a mighty slap on the back.
"Good luck, my boy. Take care of Eva."
"That's a promise."
Fairweather nodded.
"Nice to have known you, old chap." As they went up the stairway together into the fight above, a female medic rose from a wounded man and waved for Pitt's attention.
"How does it look?" she asked.
"Prepare for the worst," Pitt answered quietly.
"How long?"
"Captain Pembroke Smythe and what's left of your team are making a last stand. The end can't be more than 10 or 15 minutes away."
"What about these poor devils?"
The medic indicated the wounded strewn on the floor of the arsenal.
"The Malians won't be showing any compassion," Pitt answered her heavily. Her eyes widened slightly.
"They're not taking prisoners?"
He shook his head. "It doesn't look that way."
"And the women and children?"
He didn't answer, but the pained look of sorrow written on his face told her the worst. She made a brave effort to smile.
"Then I guess those of us who can still pull a trigger will go out with a bang."
Pitt gripped her by the shoulders for a moment, then released her. She smiled bravely and turned to pass on the dire news to her fellow medic. Before Pitt could step over to where Eva was lying, he was approached by the French engineer Louis Monteur.
"Mr. Pitt?"
"Mr. Monteur?"
"Has the time come?"
"Yes, I'm afraid it has."
"Your gun. How many shells does it carry?"
10, but I have another clip with 4.
"We only need 11 for the women and children," Monteur whispered as he held out his hand for the weapon.
"You may have it after I've taken care of Dr. Rojas," Pitt said with quiet firmness.
Monta looked up as the sounds of the fighting above came closer and echoed down the stairway.
Do not take too long.
Pitt moved away and sat on the stone floor beside Eva. She was awake and looked up at him with an unmistakable expression of affection and concern.
You're bleeding. You're wounded.
He shrugged. I forgot to duck when the grenade went off.
I'm so glad you're here.
I was beginning to wonder if I was ever going to see you again. I hope you have a dress all picked out for our date, he said, as he put his arm around her shoulders and gently moved her until her head rested in his lap. Out of sight, behind her view, he eased the automatic from his belt and held the muzzle a centimeter behind her right temple.
I have a restaurant all picked out.
She hesitated and tilted her head as if listening.
Did you hear it?
Hear what?
I'm not sure. It sounded like a whistle.
Pitt was certain the sedatives had caused her mind to wander. There was no way a strange sound could be heard above the din of the fighting. His finger began to tighten on the trigger.
I didn't hear anything, he said. No. No, there it is again.
He hesitated as her eyes came alive and reflected a vague sort of anticipation. But he willed himself to go through with it. He leaned down to kiss her lips and distract her as he began to squeeze the trigger again. She tried to lift her head.
You must hear it.
Goodbye, love.
A train whistle, she said excitedly. It's Al. He's come back.
Pitt released the pressure on the trigger and cocked his head toward the upper entrance to the stairway. Then he heard it over the sporadic gunfire. Not a whistle, but the faint blare of a diesel locomotive air horn. Giordino stood beside the engineer and pulled the air horn cord like a crazy man as the train thundered over the rails toward the fighting. He stared and stared at the fort, hardly recognizing the ravaged structure as it grew larger through the windshield of the locomotive cab. The utter devastation, the pall of black smoke rising in the sky, made him sick at heart. From all appearances, the relief force was too late. Hargrove gazed, fascinated. He couldn't believe that anyone could live through such destruction. Most all the parapets were shot away, the ramparts in unbelievable shambles. The front wall, where the main gate once stood, was nothing but a small mountain of tangled stone. He was astounded at the number of bodies strewn about the perimeter of the fort and the four burned-out tanks.
God, but they put up a hell of a fight, Hargrove muttered in awe.
Giordino pressed the muzzle of a pistol against the engineer's temple. Lay on the brakes and stop this thing, now! The engineer, a Frenchman, who had been pirated away from operating the super-fast TVG train between Paris and Lyon by double the salary from Massard Enterprises, applied the brakes, stopping the train directly between the fort and Kazim's field headquarters. With clock-like precision, Hargrove Special Operations warriors poured off the train in both directions simultaneously and hit the ground running. One unit launched an immediate attack on the Malian field headquarters, catching Kazim and his staff by complete surprise. The rest of the force began assaulting the Malian army from the rear. The covers were quickly thrown off the Apache helicopters that were tied down on the flatbed cars. Within 2 minutes they were lifting into the air, swinging into position to fire their Hellfire missiles. In the sudden panic and confusion, Kazim stood rooted at the realization that the American Special Forces had sneaked across the border under the noses of his air screen. He was sick to his stomach in shock and made no effort to direct a defense or run for cover. Colonels Mansa and Chaik each grabbed Kazim by an arm and hustled him out of his headquarters tent into a staff car as Captain Batuta quickly jumped behind the wheel. Ismail Yerli shared their love of self-preservation and climbed in the seat beside Batuta. Get out of here, Mansa shouted at Batuta, as he and Chaik climbed in the back seat on each side of Kazim. In the name of Allah, move before we are all killed. Batuta had no more wish to die than his superiors. Leaving their men to fight out of the trap on their own, the officers had no second thoughts about fleeing the battlefield to save their own skins. Frightened beyond logical thinking, Batuta raced the engine and threw the staff car in gear. Though the vehicle was a four-wheel drive, he dug the tires deeply in the soft sand, cutting twin trenches without achieving traction. In panic, Batuta kept his foot jammed on the accelerator.
The engine shrieked in protest at the excessive revolutions as he stupidly made matters worse by driving the wheels into the ground up to their axle hubs. Mouthing soundless words, Kazim abruptly returned to reality, and his face twisted in terror.
"Save me!" he screamed. "I order you to save me!"
"You fool!" Mansa yelled at Batuta. "Let off the gas or we'll never get away!"
"I'm trying!" Batuta snapped back, sweat bursting from his forehead.
Only Yerli sat calmly and accepted his fate. He stared out the side window silently as he watched death approaching in the shape of a big, purposeful-looking man in American desert combat gear. Master Sergeant Jason Rasmussen of Paradise Valley, Arizona, had led his team off the train and straight at Kazim's headquarters tents. Their job was to capture the communications section and prevent the Malians from spreading an alarm that would bring on an attack by Kazim's air force. In and out, faster than a vampire pisses blood, as Colonel Hargrove had expressed it so picturesquely during the briefing, or else they were all dead meat if the Malian jet fighters caught them before their helicopters could recross the Mauritanian border. After his team members had swept aside weak resistance from the stunned Malian soldiers and achieved their goal of cutting off all communications, Rasmussen noticed the staff car out of the corner of his eyes and began running after it. From the rear, he could make out three heads in the back seat and two in the front. His first thought, when he saw that the car appeared stuck in the sand, was to take the men inside as prisoners. But then the vehicle suddenly leaped forward and bounced onto firm ground. The driver cautiously increased speed, and the car began to pull away. Rasmussen opened up with his machine gun. His fire peppered the doors and windows. Glass shattered and sparkled in the bright sun as bullets stitched across the car doors. After he emptied two clips, the heavily riddled car slowed and rolled to a halt. As he cautiously approached, Rasmussen saw that the driver had slumped lifeless over the wheel. The body of a senior Malian officer was leaning halfway out one window, while another officer had fallen from an open door to his back on the ground and stared vacantly into the sky. A third man sat in the middle of the back seat, eyes wide open as if he was peering at some distant object while under hypnosis. The man in the passenger's seat in front, though, had a strange, peaceful look in sightless eyes. To Rasmussen, the officer in the middle looked like some kind of cartoon field marshal. The coat of his uniform was covered in a maze of gold braid, sashes, ribbons, and medals. Rasmussen could not bring himself to believe this character was the leader of the Malian forces. He leaned through the open door and gave the high-ranking officer a nudge with his gun butt. The body sagged sideways on the seat, revealing two neat bullet holes through the spinal cord at the base of the neck. Sergeant First Class Rasmussen checked to see if the others were beyond medical help. All had suffered fatal wounds. Rasmussen had no idea that he had accomplished his mission far away and above expectations. Without direct orders from Kazim or his immediate staff, there were no subordinate officers willing to call an airstrike on their own. Single-handedly, the sergeant from Arizona had changed the face of a West African nation. In the wake of Kazim's death, a new political party supporting democratic reform would sweep out the old leaders of Mali and launch a new government, one that was unfavorable toward the manipulations of scavengers like Yves Massard. Unaware he had altered history, Rasmussen reloaded his weapon, dismissed the carnage from his mind, and trotted back to help in mopping up the area. Nearly 10 days would pass before General Kazim was buried in the desert beside his final defeat, unmourned, his grave forever unmarked.